League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to Flat Chat. I'm Stuart Codling, and I'm joined by Mark Gallagher and Ben Anderson. Now, we initially recorded this podcast at the beginning of what turned out to be a very, very crazy week in motor racing. Things escalated very quickly down in Australia, so we decided to keep our powder dry and sit on this recording until after the dust had settled, as it were. If you'd like to hear a forensic examination of what happened in Australia, I recommend the Autosport podcast, hosted by Alex Kalanorkas and featuring Luke Smith and Johnny Noble. In the interim, here's Flat Chat.
Well, the supermarket shelves may have been stripped clean of toilet roll and hand sanitizer, but there's a new issue of GP Racing magazine out there. There's something else out there too. This edition of Flat Chat is brought to you in association with Formula One: The Champions, the new book by Morris Hamilton. Since the start of the Formula One World Championship in 1950, just 33 men have achieved the feat of becoming the champion. For the first time, legendary F1 commentator Morris Hamilton and the award-winning photographers Bernard and Paul-Henri Cailler bring the heroes of this iconic sport together in a stunning photographic portrayal of the poise, skill, and winning mindset that separates the fast from the furious, the elite from the talented. I put us in the elite and the talented. With previously unpublished photographs from across the history of Formula One, quotes from icons such as Lewis Hamilton and Sir Jackie Stewart, and Morris's historic interviews with the sport's lost heroes, Formula One: The Champions is a tribute to the most ferocious of sports and the incredible sportsmen who drive at the limit in pursuit of greatness. Out now and available from all good bookshops and online. Great read it is too, as you'd expect from Morris. We've enjoyed our office copy before someone wandered off with it. Anyhow, I'm Stuart Codling, and joining me in the studio is editor Ben Anderson, editor of GP Racing magazine, fresh from holiday.
What have I missed?
Sanitise your hands, down the line and not self-isolating. Yeah, it's Mark Gallagher.
Very much enjoying the opportunity to chat to you guys today about GP Racing magazine and all that's within that. How's the new name going down?
My parents don't understand what's going on, because in the weekly the weekly phone call yesterday, my mother said, "How are you? Your father says there's a new Formula One magazine out." They had seen GP Racing and thought it was a different magazine.
Well, I have to say, and I'm just going to be completely sycophantic now and say, I think it looks amazing. It's a great front cover. You've done a great job, guys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we hoped that it would be seamless for all readers to transition from F1 racing to GP racing. So we hope that Codder's parents are the exception, not the rule.
Indeed. And the only complaints we've had so far are from people who have opened it expecting to find the free Formula One diary stickers and found that someone else have nicked the stickers from within their magazine. So I've been stuffing a few envelopes this morning, hoping to satisfy a few irked readers who'd gone stickerless. But anyhow, yeah, it's business as usual as civilization collapses around us. And on the cover, we have Lewis Hamilton and his journey to greatness. He's on his way to equaling Michael Schumacher's 7 world titles this season. But Andrew Benson, within our pages, perhaps argues that he's surpassed him in terms of all-round meganess as well. And surprisingly for Andrew, has managed to go a whole feature without really, really mentioning Fernando Alonso.
I'm sure he wanted to.
he does actually get a small mention. He makes a cameo appearance like Alfred Hitchcock in one of his own films.
Well, I suppose, you know, you can't. If you're talking about the great drivers, Alonso's still in the conversation, isn't he? But, I mean, this feature is not about Fernando, so we won't go down that route. It's the setup for this season, isn't it? It's in terms of the pure numbers and the big picture. It's, can Lewis equal Schumacher's tally of championships? Can he surpass him in the next 2-3 seasons? Certainly, it's possible. What was looking once impossible to him is now looking ever more likely. And this feature really is an attempt to kind of compare their careers up to this point, the similarities, the differences. And I think Andrew was the perfect person to tackle this brief on the basis that he has covered both drivers' careers extensively during his long period in Formula One as one of the leading journalists.
Been pulling all his hair out over both drivers, hasn't he? But the this feature went up on Autosport Plus over the weekend, and it was interesting to see. You obviously get the snap reactions on social media whenever our colleagues on Autosport post an article, they tweet about it, and you get the hot takes from people who haven't actually read it but are reacting to the sell. And there are a lot of people who say, you can't compare them, blah, 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 and let the rampaging anger go forth. But there is an interesting contention within the feature, isn't there, that Michael, to an extent, although he did build teams around him, he was kind of de facto number one, whereas Lewis has had to fight to be number one at every team he's been in.
Yeah, I think that's probably the main point of difference. You know, you could argue that they had similar gilded paths into Formula One, if you like. I mean, Schumacher was backed by Mercedes early in his career, like Lewis technically was through McLaren. But the big difference is that Hamilton has had fight to create his status as the era's defining driver and the number one within his team. Andrew deals with the recent period at Mercedes where Lewis was battling Nico Rosberg for ascendancy in that operation, and I think it was clear he was the best driver, but you know, Mercedes were going to great lengths to give their drivers equal treatment, not favour one over the other, and it caused huge tension. And in the end, you know, Lewis won through, you know, the measure of his talent, really, or his, you know, his ability to extract more from that package than his teammate more often, although obviously Rosberg nicked that one championship in 2016. Whereas in Michael's case, it was always a bit different. You know, his teammates were very much, you know, playing second fiddle. Eddie Irvine used to talk about how, you know, he knew exactly what he was getting into when he signed on the dotted line to move to Ferrari. And I remember hearing an anecdote from someone who worked for Ferrari not so long ago, a press conference after the infamous 2002 Austrian Grand Prix, where Ferrari drivers were booed on the podium over their handling of Barrichello.
I was sitting in the airport nursing a Weiss beer when that went on, because I had the bag of film with me to take to the chemist or wherever we took the films back in those days.
Needless team orders shenanigans at that point, given how dominant the package was. And the first question in the press conference after the race apparently was, Michael, are you the best driver in Formula One, or do you just have the best contract?
And quite cruel.
And but that is something that, you know, always followed Schumacher around, and that's not something that's ever been levied at Lewis.
Not wrong. And Lewis has changed a fair bit over the years, hasn't he? When you're a Formula One fan, or you work in the sport and you're exposed to him all the way through the season, you probably don't notice that so much. But one thing that jumped out at me when I was having a look at Mark's column for next month's issue of GP Racing is the reaction at that Singapore conference of people who weren't necessarily embedded in motor racing and hadn't really encountered Lewis before, and the effect he had on those people. So Mark, you were obviously there in Singapore with Lewis before it went into lockdown. So what did you make about it from
there? Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, and Ben's absolutely right. You know, when you follow Lewis's career and you look at the way that he's had to, you know, okay, battle his way along, albeit against a background where he had terrific support at McLaren from Ron Dennis from the get-go, and there's no question Mercedes really wanted to have him, and have you know, from day one it was clear that Lewis was likely to effectively become number one, even if that's not perhaps what his contract said. But what was interesting working with him in Singapore at the beginning of February was to see how he is in a completely non-Formula One environment. No F1 media, no F1 sponsors, no one from his team around. Just had his good friend Mark Hines with him, and you know, they were both very relaxed. And it was also his first commitment of 2020 following his winter break. So he really was fresh from the slopes of Colorado or wherever he had been spending his downtime. And he came across so calm and at one with himself, very, very contented. His responses to questions were telling in that they were instant and yet very, you could tell a lot of thought has gone into it. He has put a lot of consideration into where he is in his career. And he, without being prompted, you know, he came straight off with the fact that Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc are both 22 years of age. And at the beginning, or in Max's case, now well into what are likely to be very long and successful careers. So he's, and it's very interesting that he mentioned those two drivers. He went on to say, not discounting Sebastian Vettel, and then went on to say, and of course, then I have this strong teammate in Valtteri Bottas, but there was kind of no doubting where Lewis in his own mind sees, you know, the rivalry certainly for him and Mercedes coming from. And then positioning his kind of the context within which he's racing in Formula One. He's 35 years of age. He is the second oldest driver in Formula One. This is his 14th season in Formula One. So he knows all those statistics. He knows exactly where he's at. And you get a real sense of, you know, he's at one with himself. He's at that point, that wonderful point that multiple world champions get to, where they're been there, they've done it, they know exactly what's required. If the team gives them a competitive car, they know they'll win with it. If they don't give them a competitive car, they're hopeful that they can help them to find out what the issues are. He told a very interesting story about pre-season testing in 2019, where he said they really had struggled for a number of days. They'd struggled, and then he got to the final day, and he told the story that he said to the engineers, look, can I just make some suggestions? Can we take the setup in a slightly different direction? And he said, we found a really sweet spot on that day, which really set us up for the season. And he said, I got so much satisfaction out of doing that, because he said, I'm surrounded by incredibly clever people, much, much cleverer than I am in terms of engineering. But he was making it clear that as a driver, he knows he's got the wherewithal at this stage in his career to really drive the team technically in some ways, but also from a leadership point of view. So as you just alluded to, Stuart, the feedback I got from people who were there, people who perhaps are not Formula One fans or have watched Lewis from afar, overwhelmingly impressed. And I mean, they said things which maybe might seem patronizing, but I think you have to take it in the context of people who watch other sports. They couldn't believe how articulate he was. They couldn't believe how he was able to hold the audience, share stories, and to do so in a very humble way. And I think for some people who have followed Lewis on social media, they mightn't think, well, is this a very humble, down-to-earth guy? Actually, that's how he comes across when you meet him. And he was very sincere about a lot of the points that we put to him. So really, he impressed that room, which was full of very, very senior business people from all over the world. And for me, I found it absolutely fascinating to see the degree of calmness that he has going into this year, and how much he is relishing not just Formula One this year, but also into the future. And this is a guy who clearly feels he's got a lot more still to deliver, and he definitely plans to deliver it.
Yeah, he's perfectly in his groove, isn't he, at the moment, I feel. Since the Nico Rosberg era ended for him, he's seemed much more relaxed. And winning those two extra championships after such a long wait from the first one, I think that was a big part of it too. You know, there's a lot of pressure on him winning title number two, given, you know, what an impact he had as a young driver. And you can see he's kind of relaxed into things more. And I think the big lesson he's taken from the Rosberg period as well is that he isn't a lone ranger in this. He obviously knew it was a team sport, but I never felt that he perhaps understood how to get the most out of the team around him in the way that he does now. And, you know, he probably would have felt that Rosberg was using the team against him in a negative way, but nevertheless was making more of his surroundings in order to compete with Lewis, who, you know, let's face it, was the better driver of the two. And I think Lewis has understood the power of the people around him. If he can just start extracting a few percent more out of other individuals that make up the collective, he benefits in a much bigger way and the whole performance lifts. And I think that's what you've seen in the last three seasons. And he's taken everything on to the next level, and he seems almost impervious now. And of course, then the other factor is his own motivation. And I get the sense he gets a real kick out of the fact that there are these two young guys he's mentioned, Leclerc and Verstappen, who are trying to take it to him. And he wants to stick around to defeat them and prove that, you know, he can be the best in the world, even though he's got so many years on them and is in, you know, nearer the end of his career than he is the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, Ben, you're one of the things which, you know, I think is really interesting is you spend more and more time around racing drivers, you get a sense of where they are in their head. And Lewis is in such a good place in his head. And I'm not sure if I mentioned Trevor Foster in my column or not, I can't remember, but Trevor Foster, who was managing director at Jordan and now works, I think, at United Autosports, very, very clever guy and a great team manager. I remember Trevor saying to me about Schumacher, the difference between Michael and everyone else is Michael goes to a track on Sunday morning knowing he's going to win. The rest arrive at the track hoping they're going to win. And he said that he has developed that knowledge, that certainty, that which is why he looks bemused in a press conference if he hasn't won the race, because actually that does not compute. And I think for Lewis, that's also true. He goes to a race not being complacent that, you know, it's going to be easy. He goes to every race knowing it's going to be difficult. I asked him a question, actually, at the Singapore event, which was about teammates. I said, you know, would your ideal teammate just be somebody who's just naturally slower than you? And he said, I want the opposite. And he said, actually, not just of my teammates. He said, I really hope that every driver who turns up in Formula One in 2020 is the best they've ever been in their career, because then it's worth beating them. And he didn't say, and that wasn't, he wasn't saying that with some PR guy at the side of the stage having given them the line. That came straight from Lewis Hamilton. He wants to win the world championship against the best drivers, being the best version of themselves. And to go back to another point you just mentioned, Ben, about Lewis building the team around him, he also talked about his position in the team as a leader. And he made a very interesting point about the fact that he now realizes at this stage in his career that when he walks into the garage in the morning or he walks into the factory in Brackley, everyone feeds off his mood. So if he goes in with a smile on his face and upbeat, it helps to lift the team. And if he, alternatively, if he goes in gloomy and despondent, you know, there's a potential for that to bring the team down. And he really sees that as being a responsibility that he has. He said these people work all the hour that God sends them. They are very committed to giving me the best, you know, car in the world. And it's not easy. And the competition, they're giving us, you know, hell all the time. So he knows that for most of the people who work in the team, it's just a slog. And therefore, when he turns up, it's really important that he gives them a sense of purpose and injects energy into it. Now, I thought, again, that was it was interesting to hear him as a driver recognizing the role that he has to play as team leader. So Toto Wolff may be the boss and indeed a very inspirational boss by all accounts at Mercedes-Benz, but Lewis definitely sees that the dynamic in the team is going to be helped enormously by his attitude and the way he approaches things. And you would have to say at this stage, you know, when you read this article that, you know, this feature that Andrew has written, and you think about Lewis's success, and then put yourself in the position of being a mechanic or an engineer or working in the factory or working in marketing or whatever department in Mercedes-Benz that you work in, everyone there must now be conscious of the fact that they have driving for them the one guy who absolutely can deliver. They give him the best product in the world. He's going to deliver more race victories and more world championship successes, which is good for every employee in Mercedes-Benz in Brackley and also at the powertrain division up in Brixworth. So Lewis is, you know, Lewis is a plug and play solution for a team like that, which wants to win. And that's, you know, that's of invaluable proportions, really.
It's interesting you raise that point, because we've also spoken to George Russell in this issue. And he, of course, was the Mercedes reserve driver before he went on to race for Williams. And he says that it wasn't until he'd got into Formula One and he'd seen Lewis in action that he realized what power the driver has, and how just a few badly misjudged comments in a debrief can send 60 or more people into work in a bad mood the following Monday and not ready to give of their best. So he said he's learned a lot from Lewis in that regard.
Yeah, and I think an invaluable lesson for someone like George at the very start of his career. And you could argue perhaps that that was a weakness of Lewis before, if you're weighing him up against Schumacher in legacy terms. You know, Schumacher was obviously well attuned to the team dynamic early on, and, you know, however you feel about it, contractually made sure that he had the right pieces in place to get the most out of himself, and then rode that wave to many championships and, you know, records we thought would never be beaten. And Lewis has arguably come to that party quite late in his career, but he's done it in time. And of course, once he has realized the power of the others around him, or the full power of them, he's absolutely flown. And I guess it's never too late to learn. That's the other thing that's impressive about Lewis. He just keeps getting better. And at the moment, you don't feel like he's peaked.
Yeah, he's got a sort of aura about him as well. And it was interesting to see him appear over the winter. It must have been 2 or 3 months ago, he appeared on the Graham Norton show on a Friday night. And he had that guest slot where he's not in, he doesn't turn up on the sofa first thing. They sort of send the first 2 or 3 guests out. And they've obviously...
Not one of Norton's mates.
they've obviously had a couple of cheeky drinks in the green room beforehand, and they're all laughing and bantering. And if you observe carefully between shots, their beers or their red wine glasses or whatever have been topped up. And there's a bit of lighthearted banter and badinage going on. And then they wheeled Lewis out, and it was almost like the teacher had walked into the classroom, and they sort of stopped and they waited to see what he'd do. And they kind of fed off him because he had this sort of natural leadership aura. And you got the impression that he was someone who didn't really waste words or waste time. And you sort of had to kind of respect them. And they weren't quite sure where to press him in terms of banter. And as it happens, that none of them fired up the Bantasaurus with Lewis. So we didn't actually get to see him exercise his wits. But just quite a fascinating sort of experience of him outside his normal environment and watching how he behaves and how other people react to him. I found it quite interesting.
Well, you get the sense that Lewis, the longer this goes on and the more successful he is, he's obviously makes a lot of effort to do this as well, but he's starting to burst the bubble of Formula One a little bit, and more people are becoming aware of how of the sport in one sense, but also how successful he is as a sports person. You get people, you know, high up in football and what have you, who start to talk about Lewis Hamilton as potentially one of the best British athletes or sportsmen ever. So there's a huge legacy there that he's building that goes beyond Formula One in our context. And I get the sense that Lewis is aware of this, and that he could, you know, finish his career as, you know, perhaps the greatest of all time in more senses than just, you know, pure numbers.
Yeah, it's interesting that also that he, in recognizing that he's on the cusp of real true greatness, he appears to be genuinely sorry about the fact that he remains the only black driver likely to, you know, win the world championship anytime soon. And he talked about that quite a bit at the event that we did in Singapore, and again wasn't prompted to. He opened the discussion around diversity, you know, encouraging ethnic minorities into Formula One. It's still being predominantly a white European man sport, and you know, talked about the importance of bringing women on in sport as well. And again, talked about it in a very earnest and sincere way. And it wasn't being hyped up. He wasn't saying "poor me," you know, growing up as a, you know, in a mixed race family or anything like that. He was saying, actually, anyone can achieve their dreams if they really you know, surround themselves with the right people and don't give up and keep on pushing. And he talked about the fact that, I mean, he actually said, I don't see another black driver winning a Formula One race, for 20 years after I stop. And he said, that's a real shame. So he talked again about his interest in working with the FIA to make lower categories of racing less expensive, of creating opportunities for people from any country and any segment of society, if they want to become a racing driver, to be able to do that. And again, really interesting, unprompted and authentic sort of comments from him around that. And I think in terms of the future, one thing that is very striking is that he clearly isn't thinking about retiring soon, but he has thought about retirement as part of a long-term retirement from Formula One driving as part of a long-term plan. And again, in mentioning that he's 35 years of age and then talking about kind of 3 or 4 years time. So he's thinking about 38, 39, which seems sensible. It seems likely to be the time when he perhaps will stop. And then going on to talk in great detail about his excitement about life after Formula One. And he said, you know, he's read a lot of books about other sportsmen and women and athletes who have gotten to the end of their professional sporting career and everything just stops. The phone stops ringing. They haven't thought about life after their sporting career. And he said, I've decided to do the opposite. I've turned it on its head. So it wasn't in response to any criticism that I'd mentioned to him. But again, you can see that his view is when people don't understand his love of fashion, when people don't understand his love of music and the amount of time that he spends on these, I mean, they're not hobbies, they're more than that, these potential long-term career opportunities, this is all part of his grand plan. He really came across as extremely excited for the next 3 or 4 years in Formula One and what those are going to bring him, and then equally excited about what's going to happen when he stops racing in Formula One. And you get the feeling he cannot wait for that to happen. So it's a very very rounded kind of approach that he has. Mission is not accomplished in Formula One. Plenty of races still to come, plenty of victories, more world championship titles. I think if those bring him more success than Schumacher in terms of the numerical side of the statistics, of course he's going to be delighted with that. You don't get the impression that he lies awake at night worrying about whether he will win more world championship titles than Michael Schumacher. Lewis Hamilton knows in his mind he should have won the world championship 7 times already because, you know, there but for an engine failure in Malaysia, he would have beaten Nico Rosberg that year. So the reality is he's aware that not everything works out, but his trajectory continues to be pretty spectacular, and he's got plenty of fuel left in the tank. You know, 3 or 4 seasons ahead, Lewis Hamilton's got plenty of time to notch up another couple of world championship titles if Mercedes keep delivering the best product that they can for him.
And it sounds like you can maybe expect a few more bookings when he does finally stop as well, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's interesting. He admitted to not nervousness. That's not the word he used. But you can tell that when it comes to public speaking, he is very conscious of it being a real skill and one that you have to work at. And yeah, I found him to be very unhesitant. He was very articulate in his delivery, but you could see before we went on stage that he's thinking about the audience, he's thinking about how he comes across. And actually subsequently he got the World Sportsman of the Year awards at the Laureus Awards and gave what I thought was an excellent speech. And when you watch it, you can see that he's going through a mental Rolodex. People might not remember what a Rolodex was, but he's got his mental filing system of the points that he needs to make. So he mentioned all the right points during his speech at the Laureus Awards, an audience full of celebrities, top people from his world of sport all over the, from around the globe and from lots of different sports, and he delivered it very well. But you can see that he's practicing how he comes across and that he wants to articulate the right messages. He doesn't want to come off the stage and think, oh, I forgot to mention the sponsor's name. He doesn't want to come off the stage and think, ah, there was a point that I meant to mention around diversity, or there was a point I meant to mention about the support that I get from the Mercedes team. So he's learned how to bullet point his presentations, get the message across, communicate it. And actually, he does so in a way, he does so with a very, he's very quietly spoken. And again, that was a comment that a lot of people said to me after the event that we did. They said, wow, you know, he doesn't come across as, you know, in your face, sort of loud, aggressive, arrogant. It's all the opposite. It's all the good stuff. It's modest. It's humble. It's quietly spoken. It's very well delivered. It's very considered. And very happy to give credit to the team and those around him for having helped him. So I think this is, I've really come away from that event with a different perspective on Lewis. I now realize that the social media Lewis Hamilton that you see, the Instagram Lewis Hamilton, the Twitter Lewis Hamilton, some of the things that perhaps the haters, and let's face it, we all see the haters for Lewis Hamilton online, the things that the haters grasp to try and detract from him as a person or as a driver, they don't stand up at all in person. And he is a very impressive individual to therefore see in action up close and to spend some time with. So I think it's he's essentially quite a shy guy with a superior talent as a racing driver who's absolutely delivered to the limit of his ambitions. And those ambitions still have some way to come. So it's going to be an interesting few years. I can tell Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc need to very quickly establish their solidity within their teams and their number one position within their teams, and to achieve that level of surety that Lewis Hamilton has at Mercedes if they're ever to stand a chance of beating him in a world championship fight.
Well, that's something I think the Verstappen clan keenly understands.
Yeah, well, you spoke to Jos, the boss, didn't you, with your little thing in this month's issue with and about Max, and Jos had some fascinating little drops of info.
Yes, yeah, we wanted to do a story on, you know, Max's new contract. I mean, both Leclerc and Verstappen have signed new long-term deals with their current teams, which tells you already that they're thinking about exactly your point, Mark, which is to establish themselves properly as the focal point of those teams. And, you know, in order to beat Lewis, that's what they're going to need to do. Everyone, you know, Jos mentioned actually that, you know, in terms of reading the market, everyone is expecting, and you've mentioned this before, Mark, Lewis to sign again with Mercedes for at least two more seasons, possibly more. So they're seeing that as that empire is not crumbling anytime soon. So they're going to have to build their own if they want to challenge him. And that is a big part of the reason Jos was saying that Max decided to stay with Red Bull for such a long time, because to build, they're already in the process of building that at Red Bull. You know, they've seen Ricciardo off. Max is now the natural focal point anyway. No, never mind who they put in alongside from the Red Bull pool. And to build that same dynamic at another team, you know, Jos says that's going to take, you know, it takes at least 2-3 years. And while you're doing that, you're just handing more and more opportunities to your rivals. And, you know, we don't know exactly the ins and outs of the Leclerc situation, but I mean, he was on a junior Ferrari contract before, wasn't he? And it made sense that he would get a new deal given how spectacularly he performed. And arguably he's a little bit further behind in his progression, because he's had one season up against the established number one, Sebastian Vettel, and, you know, he got the better of him. And that dynamic is still in the process of shifting. I imagine the new contract for Leclerc tells Vettel that, you know, this is where Ferrari feels its future lies.
Yeah, shape up or ship out, I think.
Potentially. I mean, he's got obviously one more year to run on his current contract, but I imagine, you know, they've already been making noises at, you know, management level that they want Vettel to stay, and that, you know, they see him as being an important part of the team. But it's clear they don't see him being same part of the team as he was before Leclerc arrived, and probably what Vettel has to contend with is, is he happy to play second fiddle to Leclerc in, you know, the medium term, in the way that Kimi Raikkonen was seemingly happy to do for Vettel.
Yeah, Roberto Quintero has written a very interesting feature for us in this issue that covers the whole Ferrari angle, and he says that Vettel's got about 8 races to prove himself, and Roberto's very well plugged into the Ferrari machine, so he would be quite well informed on that. And obviously the Leclerc contract has now placed all the onus on Vettel to either prove himself or to basically recreate his relationship with the team, because he's not going to be the number one anymore.
Yeah, I have to say, Sebastian, big topic of conversation, I think, for all of us when we talk to anyone about Formula One. I was at the Nürburgring last week with David Coulthard, and we ended up having a chat. Obviously, David knows Seb very well. I mean, it was actually David who suggested to Red Bull Racing giving him a tryout in one of their cars when he was still driving for Toro Rosso. DC couldn't turn up to a test because of an injury.
He ended up regretting that in the long term.
Actually, do you know, it's really interesting. It's something that he really loves telling people about, because he, in a very small way, feels that it contributed to the strength of his relationship with the team, because his manager at the time is Martin Brundle, and Martin was aghast that DC would suggest putting Sebastian Vettel in the car. He said, you know, you do realize this guy will take your seat. And DC's response was, but I'm going to retire from Formula One anyway, and my job for Red Bull is to help them to develop this team. And, you know, if Sebastian's the ideal person to take the team on, then I'd rather be giving my drive to him in the long term. So that ultimately led through to that. And, again, just talking about Lewis Hamilton, DC's view on Lewis, he's obviously seen him at events over the last few months and said, wow, he's in such a good place. He's in such a good place in his life, in his head, in his sporting career. And, you know, so David was very clear about that, but also saying, you know, Sebastian could rebound. He could rebound. But it's a big ask, because we're now in 2020, his last world championship, you know, title was back in 2013. This is a hell of a hiatus for any driver in their career. And if you subscribe to the belief that in any sport, any athlete has a period of intense output when their energy levels are high, when they achieve the prime moment of their career, and then you can't recapture that. For some people it happens early, some people it happens a little bit later, and we've seen, you know, that in Formula One. Sustaining performance for more than 4 or 5 seasons is very, very difficult, which is one of the reasons why Lewis actually is so impressive, because he did have that gap in world championship title successes, and then he's recaptured it in a very dominant way. So Sebastian, it's a huge ask to expect him to come back at this stage. So although no one will ever write him off, he's still a very fast racing driver, his ability to deliver it consistently and repeatedly, race after race, putting together a world championship season, there's the query, because the mistakes have been too prevalent, and it seems a tall order to expect him to now come back and be pretty well the perfect guy that he was when he was driving for the dominant, when he was driving the dominant Red Bull back in 2010 to 2013.
Ferrari aren't going to have either the best car or maybe even the second best car based on the performance in testing. Ben, you were out trackside for a fair bit during the second Barcelona test, and you weren't massively impressed with the way the Ferrari looked, certainly in terms of the balance as much as anything, because obviously they weren't going for headline lap time, but it just looked a bit ugly out there.
Yeah, you know, testing is always a murky picture, and you never know exactly what people are doing in terms of engine mode and fuel levels and what have you. And the top teams usually run a bit heavy for a lot of the time because they can afford to, and there's a little bit of showmanship and gamesmanship going on. But yeah, the Ferrari just didn't look as together as the new Mercedes and the new Red Bull. It looked like they have an understeer problem, and that was apparent around the circuit as well. It wasn't isolated to one particular type of corner, which, you know, was the case with the McLaren, for example. They suffered at low speed, but not, they were probably one of the most impressive midfield cars at medium speed. So yeah, the Ferrari just didn't look like it was quite there. There's talk over the winter that they struggled with some of their aerodynamic development and they had to, you know, reverse engineer a few things. It's mentioned in Roberto's feature. And maybe those things are connected, and what you're seeing on the track initially is, you know, the car hasn't quite achieved what they hoped for, and they're trying to work out how to balance that. And then on top of that, you know, Sebastian Vettel was talking about the car having too much drag. The feeling elsewhere in the paddock is actually that the Ferrari engine is down on power,
which is related obviously
to this big story that's kicked off in terms of the FIA and Ferrari doing an out of court settlement over the 2019 analysis, and the other teams are up in arms and wanting to see the findings published. But of course, Vettel's comment is technically true. If your engine isn't powerful enough for you to punch the required hole through the air, then you are going to have too much drag. But, you know, on the whole, certainly that doesn't look as impressive as the Red Bull or the Mercedes. I'm not sure whether the Racing Point pink Mercedes, which everyone was getting excited about in Barcelona, will have enough performance in its tank to take Ferrari down, especially once they do a few refinements and everything else. But certainly I wouldn't be surprised if Messrs Leclerc and Vettel start the season struggling to keep pace with the Mercedes and the Red Bull.
Mark, what was your take on the how do I say this without saying something legally actionable? Well, what's your take on the whole settlement being presented as a fait accompli in the form of a 2-paragraph press release at 10 to 6 on a Friday night, just as a test's about to end, and most of the parties of the first part have already left the building, including the FIA press team?
It could be used as an example of how not to communicate with audiences and stakeholders. I read it and thought to myself, it's interesting that someone has read that and thought, yeah, that's good to go. Yeah, just send it out now. Because it was only ever going to lead to a furore with the non-Ferrari teams, which indeed it has, and also with the general public, the viewing fans who follow the sport so closely. And it's been, you know, it's been a storm. I find the whole process that the FIA and Ferrari have gone through fascinating, because when I was running Cosworth, we had a relationship with Charlie Whiting and the FIA that meant that lots of things were discussed between us, which didn't go to any other engine manufacturers. You know, we would have a reliability issue or something that we wanted to try out, or Charlie would have something he wanted to talk to us about. And there was lots of discussions which essentially were confidential and behind closed doors. And you wouldn't want the opposition to know what you were working on. And indeed, at the very heart of Formula One innovation is the fact that as a team, you might want to try a technology or a path which no one else has thought of. And you check with the FIA or the FIA comes and questions you about it. And if the decision is actually it's fine, there's no need to tell the competition, because as long as it's legal, you know, that's all and good. I think what's interesting with this wording and what's really caused such a storm is that the FIA appear to be saying, we weren't quite sure that they were within the rules, but we haven't been able to prove it. And so we've kind of said to them, well, can you try not to do that? But if it's difficult to see, if the FIA don't really understand whether it was legal or not, how did they then say to Ferrari, please don't do what you were doing? But clearly, they've said a settlement has been reached. As a result of that, Ferrari seemed to have lost some performance. So whatever that, I'm going to call it an innovation. Some people might use a stronger word. Whatever that innovation was that Ferrari had appears to have been removed. And of course, there's a deep irony about this, which is that having done what they did last season, produced a very, very fast car, all those pole positions for Charles Leclerc, lots of great potential last season. Whatever that winning card was has now been removed. And in the meantime, their performance last year spurred Mercedes to dig even deeper and push on to another level for this year. So Ferrari have effectively gone, you know, one step forward, two steps back, and Mercedes have moved two steps further on. So the gap has opened up, and actually it's also spurred Red Bull and Honda into pushing on to the next level. So it's been a very unfortunate turn for Ferrari. He didn't win the World Championship last year. Doesn't look like he'll win the World Championship this year based on what we've seen in preseason testing, as Ben says. And we now get into the realms of, you know, a question mark over Binotto. And, you know, we know what happens in Ferrari and in Maranello. They give people actually not enough time. And if the team leadership are judged by the bosses to have failed for 2 or 3 years, there's usually change. And if that's what then happens at the end of this year, coming into 2021, if there's, you know, another Maranello meltdown, it's all it's going to do is perpetuate Ferrari's inability to win world championships, because you need consistency, you need strong leadership. Companies have to learn from their mistakes. And if they've made a mistake last year by introducing something which subsequently has been decided by the FIA to not be within the rules, that's been a huge waste of time and resource and effort, and they have to start all over again. And it's going to be a long slog for them. And again, this all plays back to, you know, Lewis Hamilton's onward march towards a seventh and maybe an eighth world championship title. Because if Ferrari continue to trip themselves up, and unless Red Bull and Honda can somehow get that magic championship winning formula together, it's difficult to see Hamilton and Mercedes being stopped.
Just to play devil's advocate for a second, though, and feel free to shoot this theory down. Now, they have suggested that part of the reason for losing performance is that they've been targeting better reliability this year, and reliability did let them down a couple of times last season. There was also some discussion. I interviewed Andy Cowell of Mercedes. He said that if you chase peak power to gain small bits of lap time, then you can end up actually losing over the course of a race. So we at Mercedes don't target peak performance for peak lap time. We're looking at the big picture of the race itself. So is this actually this business of Ferrari losing performance? Is it more a question of having different targets in terms of the energy density that they produce with the engine, and that actually they've moved away from peak performance as a goal?
Well, there's an element of Ferrari strategy changing. I mean, they made a big deal out of the fact that they got excited, as we all did, pre-season testing last year, because they looked like they were a long way ahead. And in fairness, Mercedes thought the same until they made the breakthrough on setup that Mark alluded to earlier. So this year they've come in with a more conservative approach and not to get ahead of themselves. So maybe there's performance in the pocket. Also, conversely, Mercedes have introduced a new engine and they've been teething troubles. You know, there were problems related to the oil system on the works car for both Lewis and Valtteri Bottas, and on the customer Williams as well. So, you know, maybe Mercedes has overreached. We'll see, obviously, in Melbourne. Honda's the big unknown. It looked in Barcelona like they were running quite detuned a lot of the time. But then someone else in the paddock said to me, well, normally the Honda engineers, they like to lay it all on the table so they know where they are. So you'd imagine if that's true, at some point they did crank it right up to see what it could do.
Karun Jandok did say he saw Pierre Gasly all of a sudden take off like a rocket down the straight and then slow down again. So that might have been just a swift go.
Yeah, maybe you do it in a disjointed way so that you don't string a whole lap together. You know, if you know the car is good, you don't need to show it all. So it's quite interesting. You know, from a spectacle point of view, you would hope that, you know, perhaps the reliability concerns at Mercedes are genuine and that they have to run things slightly detuned in the early races, and that ties one hand behind their back maybe. And then the Red Bull Honda has performance in the pocket and they throw all that out there, and suddenly it's really close to the top. And then maybe Ferrari gets on top of its handling problems. Maybe the engine isn't all that bad after all the whatever they've had to do to reach settlement with the FIA doesn't hold them back too much. And it's the great three-way fight we've been desperately hoping for. But we always hope, don't we, every year. And it's very hard to look past Mercedes when, you know, this juggernaut's been rolling on for so long. And, you know, every year you have this problem of when you switch over your focus in terms of development and resources from current car to the next year's car. And we know Mercedes, you know, had the championship almost sewn up by France last year. certainly they didn't, you know, throw the kitchen sink in terms of development at the car in the second half of the year. And of course, that meant they were able to, you know, switch more focus to 2020 earlier, which means they can do the same again for 21. So it's very hard to stop, you know, the momentum of a team that's got on such a winning roll by getting ahead of itself and the opposition year after year after year. But we can hope.
Winning becomes a habit, doesn't it? Now, we've talked a lot about the top three, or what we expect to be the top three. What about everyone else? That midfield is looking congested and very tightly packed, and none of them really showed what they had in testing, did they? Like we saw at one point the racing point, the so-called pink Mercedes, with Sergio Perez at the wheel, go purple in the first two sectors, and then without seeming to make any sort of mistake on track, lose 0.6 of a second in the final sector. So they were all clearly not showing what they had. A lot of their laps were done, or a lot of their headline lap times were done on tyres that they say don't necessarily suit their cars and wouldn't even be used at that racetrack come the Spanish Grand Prix. So if you're looking at time set on the C4 and C5 tyres, as most of the headline times were, they don't really have any relevance, because that's the two softest tyres in the spectrum, and they won't be used in the Spanish Grand Prix. So it's largely irrelevant to race conditions.
Yeah, you're looking for snapshots in performance, aren't you? And, you know, the general atmosphere in the team, mood around the camp, you know, what does the car look like on track? What's the feedback of the team and the drivers on how the car's performing? And the midfield, you know, stable regulations, you'd expect it to be close. It was last year. If anything, it will close up further. Racing Point of you know, a much better run into this season than they've had for many years. So you'd expect them to be stronger from the start, and, you know, certainly competing for that fourth place that they've targeted rather than trying to catch everybody up. I think the feeling in the midfield is that is probably the best overall car. They feel like that team was holding back performance, but of course every team is to some extent, so you know, you won't know until they've dumped all the fuel out on Saturday in Melbourne really where they stand. I was quite impressed with McLaren, particularly at high and medium speed, and they feel that that's probably where they're strongest. I'd say that's probably the strongest of the midfield cars in that type of corner, but they have a problem at low speed with understeer. So again, is that fundamental? Is that something that they can engineer out with some setup tweaks? We don't know yet. The AlphaTauri looked like a very drivable, consistent car in all types of corner, just lacking overall load compared to, you know, sister team Red Bull, as you'd expect. But they take, you know, the previous year's suspension from Red Bull. You know, there's a closer cooperation between those two teams again. So you would expect the AlphaTauri package to be quite good as a baseline. The Haas looked good as well. Always does at Barcelona. It's so good that it's able to mask its own aerodynamic problems at Barcelona. So they particularly will struggle to read anything into testing because it's a track they always go well at. The Renault looked like a decent package as well. You'd expect them to be in the mix. They've not tried to, you know, overreact too much to last year. They've obviously got, you know, more than half an eye on 2021. That's their big opportunity now, given they're slightly behind their own target in terms of overall progression. Probably the most disappointing of the competitive midfield group, if you like, was Alfa Romeo, but they were experimenting a lot, and they had a few in the period of testing I saw. They had quite a few incidents and some damage to the car, so quite hard to read. But it looked decent at low speed. And Williams, much improved compared to the season before. You know, they obviously really struggled pre-season last year. The car was late and it was scary to drive, I think, were the words that George Russell used. The car doesn't look scary anymore. It looks, you know, fundamentally decent.
They set the second most number of laps in the second test as well, didn't they?
So it's a different world in terms of preparation, but you can see visibly the car doesn't have the same load as the others in the midfield. So I imagine they might be closer to the pack than they were last year, but I still think they'll be off the back.
Thank you, Ben Anderson. I've been Stuart Codling. This has been Flat Chat. We'll be back in another month's time. And thanks to Morris Hamilton's fabulous new book, Formula One: The Champions, producing this podcast in association with that book this month. We'll be back in another month. Thank you very much.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.